So we're watching the, where is the, am I missing? What's going on here?
Oh,
I was just trying to start the damn thing, but.
Click that.
I clicked, yeah.
Bottom left, right there.
No, I clicked on this, I guess, and I went to the
ad.
Yeah,
it's making you wait.
Do I have to start it again?
No, it's just buffering.
Can't see the buffering. It shouldn't be able to do that if it's not buffered, right? That's part of the... There we go. Okay.
Okay, so we've been through this crisis, and there are all sorts of...
Oh, this is going to be annoying if it's going to constantly...
What network are you, what Wi-Fi channel are you
on? I'm just using whatever came up here. Is there a... Is there a faster one?
I'm on...
There's a password on
the
board.
Yeah, phnet-church.
Okay, let's see what I've got. What I am on is UWnet.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, no, go to this phnet-church.
That one, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and then what's...
Password is capital S, N...
Just a minute, S, N...
Capital S.
Yeah.
Lowercase n.
Lowercase n.
Lowercase o. Star. Number 8. Lowercase d. Lowercase o. Capital X.
Okay.
Yeah, that one should be full power.
Okay. And it should still... work.
Yeah. Might make you redo the ad. Just connecting.
Now nothing's happening. Let me just refresh the screen.
And just give them the basics, you know.
I got this.
Is it that time? The son picks up the check.
Okay. All right.
Okay, so we've been through this crisis. And there are all sorts of explanatory formats out there, and it's interesting to look at the different genres. One genre is that it's all about human frailty. I mean, Alan Greenspan took refuge in the fact it's human nature, he said, you can't do anything about that. But there's a whole world of explanations that kind of say it's the predatory instincts, it's the instincts for mastery, it's the delusions of investors and the greed and all the rest of it. So there's a whole range of discussion of that. And of course, the more we learn about the daily practices on Wall Street, we kind of figure there's a great deal of truth in all of that. The second genre is that there's institutional failures. Regulators were asleep at the switch, the shadow banking system innovated outside of their purview, etc., 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 and therefore institutions have to be reconfigured, and it has to be a global effort by the G20, something of that kind. So we look at the institutional level and say that has failed and that has to be reconfigured. The third genre is to say everybody was obsessed with a false theory, they read too much Hayek and believed in the efficiency of markets, and it's time we actually got back to something like Keynes, or we took seriously Hyman Minsky's theory about the inherent instability of financial activities. The next genre is that it has cultural origins. Now, we don't hear that much in the United States, but if you were in Germany and France, many people there would kind of say, this is an Anglo-Saxon disease, and it's nothing to do with us. I happened to be in Brazil when it was going on, and Lula was kind of saying, well, first off, he was saying, oh, thank God the United States is being disciplined by the equivalent of the IMF. We've been through it 8 times in the last 25 years, and now it's their turn. Fantastic, said Lula, and all of that, and Americans I knew, until it hit them, which it does, and then they kind of changed their tune a little bit. So it was a kind of a way in which it became cultural, and you can see that, by the way, in which this whole Greek thing is being handled, the way the German press is saying, well, it's the Greek character, it's defects in the Greek character, and there's a lot of rather nasty stuff going on around that, but actually there are some cultural features which have led into it. For instance, the US fascination with home ownership, which is supposedly a deep cultural value. So 67, 68% of US households are homeowners. It's only 22% in Switzerland. Of course, it's a cultural value in the United States that's been supported by the mortgage interest tax deduction, which is a huge subsidy. It's been promoted since the 1930s, very explicitly in the 1930s, it was built up because the theory was that debt-encumbered homeowners don't go on strike. And then there's a kind of notion that there's a failure of policy, and the policy has actually intervened. And there's a funny kind of alliance emerging between the Glenn Beck wing of Fox News and the World Bank, both of whom say the problem is too much regulation of the wrong sort. So there are all of these ways, and all of them have a certain truth. And skilled writers will take one or other of those perspectives and build a story and actually write a very plausible kind of story about this. And I thought to myself, well, what kind of plausible story can I write which is none of the above? Which is one of the things I always think to myself. And it's not hard to do, particularly if you're coming from a Marxist perspective, because, you know, there aren't many people who try to do this analysis from a Marxist perspective. And I was really, really clued into this by this thing that happened at the London School of Economics about a year and a half ago, when Her Majesty the Queen asked the economists, how come you guys didn't see this thing coming? And she didn't say it exactly that way, but, you know, it's just the sentiment. And they got very upset, and then she actually called the Bank of Government, Bank of England, and said, how come you didn't see it coming? And then the British Academy put forward this, got all together, all these economists, and they came up with this fabulous letter to Her Majesty. And it was it was actually astonishing. It said, well, you know, many dedicated people, intelligent, smart, spent their lives working on aspects of this thing very, very seriously, but the one thing we missed was systemic risk. And you say, what? And then it went on to talk about a politics of denial and all the rest of it. So I thought, well, you know, systemic risk, you know, I can translate it into the Marxian thing. You're talking about the internal contradictions of capital accumulation. And maybe I should write a thing about the internal contradictions of capital accumulation and try to figure out the role of crises in the whole history of capitalism and what's specific and special about the crisis this time around. And there were two ways in which I thought I would do that. One was to sort of look at what's happened since 1970s to now. And the thesis there is that in many ways the form of this current crisis is dictated very much by the way we came out of the last one. That the problem back in the 1970s was excessive power of labor in relationship to capital. That therefore the way out of the crisis last time was to discipline labor. And we know how that was done. It was done by offshoring, it was done by, you know, Thatcher and Reagan, and it was done by neoliberal doctrine, it was done all kinds of different ways. But by 1985 or 86, the labor question had essentially been solved for capital. It had access to all of the world's labor supplies. Nobody in this particular instance has cited greedy unions as the root of the crisis. Nobody in this instance is saying it has anything to do with excessive power of labor. If anything, it's the excessive power of capital, and in particular the excessive power of finance capital, which is the root of the problem. Now, how did that happen? Well, we've been since the 1970s in a phase of what we call wage repression. That wages have remained stagnant. The share of wages in national income right throughout the OECD countries has steadily fallen. It's even steadily fallen in China, of all places. So that there are less and less being paid out in wages. Well, wages turn out to be also the money which buys goods. So if you diminish wages, then you've got a problem where, where's your demand going to come from? And the answer was, well, get out your credit cards. We'll give everybody credit cards. So we'll overcome, if you like, the problem of effective demand by actually pumping up the credit economy. And American households, British households, have all roughly tripled their debt over the last 20, 30 years. And a vast amount of that debt, of course, has been within the housing market. And out of this comes a theory which is very, very important, that capitalism never solves its crisis problems. It moves them around geographically. And what we're seeing right now is a geographical movement of that. Everybody says, well, okay, everything's beginning to recover in the United States, and then Greece goes bang, and everybody says, what about the pigs, you know? And it's interesting. You had a finance crisis, which in the financial system. You've sort of half-solved that, but at the expense of a sovereign debt crisis. Actually, if you look at the accumulation process of capital, you see a number of limits and a number of barriers. And there's a wonderful language that Marx uses in The Grundrisse, where he talks about the way in which capital cannot abide a limit. It has to turn it into a barrier which it then circumvents or transcends. And then when you look at the accumulation process, you look at where the barriers and limits might lie. And the simple way to look at it is to say, look, a typical circulation process of accumulation goes like this. You start with some money, you go into the market and you buy labor power and means of production, and you put that them to work with a given technology and organizational form. You create a commodity, which you then sell for the original money plus a profit. Now, you then take part of the profit and you recapitalize it into an expansion for very interesting reasons. Now, there are two things about this. One is there are a number of barrier points in here. How is the money got together in the right place at the right time in the right volume? And that takes financial ingenuity. So the whole history of capitalism has been about financial innovation. And financial innovation has the effect of also empowering the financiers. And the excessive power of the financiers can sometimes, they do get greedy, no question about it. And if you look at financial profits in the United States, they were soaring after 1990. They're going up like this. Profits in manufacturing were coming down like this. And you could see the imbalance. In this country, I think the way in which this country has sided with the City of London against British manufacturing since the 1950s onwards has had very serious implications for the economy of this country. You've actually screwed industry in order to keep, you know, financiers happy. Any sensible person right now would join an anti-capitalist organization. And you have to. Because otherwise we're going to have the continuation. And notice it's a continuation of all sorts of negative aspects. For instance, the racking up of wealth. You would have thought the crisis would have stopped that. Actually, more billionaires emerged in India last year than ever. They doubled last year. The wealth of the rich, I mean, just read something this morning, in this country has accelerated just 2 years, just last year. What happened was that leading hedge fund owners got personal remunerations of $3 billion each in 1 year. Now, I thought it was obscene and insane a few years ago when they got $250 million. But they're now hauling in $3 billion. Now, that's not a world I want to live in, and if you want to live in it, be my guest. I don't see us debating and discussing this. I don't have the solutions. I think I know what the nature of the problem is. And unless we're prepared to have a very broad-based discussion that gets away from, you know, the normal kind of pablum you get in the political campaign and, you know, everything's going to be okay here next year if you vote for me, it's crap. You should know it's crap and say it is. And we have a duty, it seems to me, those of us who are academics and seriously involved in the world, to actually change our mode of thinking.
Okay. I think that's about as effective an introduction to the dynamic problem of capitalism, focused on its crisis aspects. I'll be briefly reviewing the
the logic of the dynamics of capitalism, just again as stage setting, not exclusively in terms of how it is disrupted, but also how it functions. I'm rarely jealous in academic life. I celebrate my colleagues' fantastic achievements, but I have to say, I'm jealous of David Harvey's 11-minute animation. You know, I would love to have an 11-minute YouTube animation on Real Utopias. I don't. For whatever, either I don't have the connections or I don't have the particular charm to to be able to produce something of that sort. All right, so let's just very quick. Does everybody have their outline from last time? Okay, so here's outline from last time. We got through a series of discussions about concepts, levels of abstraction, how to think about an economic structure at different levels of abstraction, what the central structural definition of capitalism is, which is static. It says, if you arrive on a new planet and you're exploring it and you come to a civilization and you want to know what kind of economy does this have, it has to have some kind of economy. If it's a civilization, that is, if the creatures get together to produce and transform nature to satisfy needs, they've got to somehow coordinate themselves. There's two sorts of things you would look for. What's the class structure and what's the mechanism of coordination? And if you got those two things well described, you're pretty far along in getting a sense of how it's organized economically. That's called the mode of production approach. It's very abstract. For capitalism, you have a simple, super simple class structure, two kinds of positions, and a very simple coordination mechanism, markets and only markets. Well, actual economies are way more complex than that, and they're complex for two kinds of reasons. This is where we sort of ended. First, you never have an economy that's just one way of doing it. So even capitalism is always articulated with or interpenetrated with. You know, there's different ways you can think about how they all fit together or don't with other non-capitalist forms of production. And the one that I mentioned because it's incredibly important and often forgotten is household production. Everybody, even if all you do is brew your coffee in the morning and everything else you eat in the restaurant, you know, you could buy all your clothes ready-made from stores, eat every meal in McDonald's, God forbid. That is, you could have a fully commodified life. You still probably don't go to the dentist to have them brush your teeth every night. That is, you actually do some of the self-maintenance of toothbrushing and probably brew your own coffee. Well, that's domestic production, brewing your own coffee. You're making a use value for your own consumption, not for somebody else's. You buy the inputs, but you do the final step in the production process of a cup of coffee in the morning. Okay, so domestic production is non-capitalist. And it's pretty important. If you count the number of hours spent in the American economy, you know, it's a hard exercise, but it's kind of interesting. Some people have done this full accounting of the number of hours in the economy spent producing the goods and services which people consume. And you ask how many hours are produced inside the domestic economy compared to in the market economy. It's a massive sector. You know, even in this highly commodified world, still most meals are prepared at home. You know, most meals consumed in America are not consumed in fast food places. Now that's increased fantastically over the past generation. You know, it used to be a treat to go out to eat dinner, to have a meal. Now it's a kind of routine, particularly in urban settings. It's a kind of routine. People eat out all the time. That's the commodification of domestic labor. Okay, repeating too much from the previous time, but I think it's interesting and important to just keep this in mind. Every economic structure is an articulation of multiple modes of production. To say that an economy is capitalist is a shorthand for we live in an economic structure within which capitalism is the dominant mode of production. The word dominant there turns out to be a really tough one to nail down. It's not so easy. I'll tell you, I mean, I can tell you on another occasion my personal saga in trying to grapple with the notion of dominance. It's a hard concept, but it has an intuitive understanding. And for the moment, I think the intuitive sense of this is a capitalist economy. It's defining the basic rhythms of our society. It imposes huge constraints on things we want to do in life. Well, that's the way to think of dominance. Pervasive, constantly confronting you with limits. It's good enough, I think, for the moment. All right, those are all the structural aspects of capitalism in its definition. But capitalism isn't just a static structure of relations in which people live their lives. It also has what are called dynamics. The term dynamic is used to describe a system in motion. And in the case of capitalism, a system that is in motion in such a way that it changes over time. It has a developmental logic, not just a energetic logic. It's not just that things are in motion, booming and buzzing around. Every system, feudalism has a is dynamic in that sense, but not all systems are dynamic in the sense of having endogenous sources of change. Endogenous, just to be sure everybody knows what that word means, endogenous is contrasted to exogenous. Endogenous are causal processes internal to a system. Exogenous are processes external to a system. So the Inca civilization collapsed for exogenous reasons. The Spanish arrived with their influenza, as much as with their swords. Influenza destroyed the Inca civilization. That's an exogenous explanation. It wasn't the internal contradictions of Inca society that led to its collapse. There were internal contradictions of Inca society. But that's not what explains its collapse. It was exogenous. Well, the thing about capitalism, which is so fascinating, is the strength of its endogenous forces of transformation. And that's what Marx embraced, what Marx really saw and understood, was that this is different. We're in a world where there are internal mechanisms which propel a system into new forms. How do we understand it? That's what the dynamic problem is. So, first issue is, how do we understand these dynamics? What are the core dynamic properties of capitalism as a mode of production? So we're ratcheting back up to this high level of abstraction. There may be additional dynamic issues that come into play when we move down to the actual way real capitalist societies work, because they're always in combination with other things. The dynamism that's specific to Chinese capitalism is not just because of the dynamism of capitalism, it's because of the particular configuration of capitalism and non-capitalist forms that come into play in fueling a state-centered capitalist dynamic of a very distinctive character that's characterized the last couple of decades of Chinese development. You could never predict that just from the mode of production analysis. You need to add something, which is this lower level abstraction. But here, let's talk at this most abstract level. Two central mechanisms of dynamics, competition and class struggle, or class conflict. Competition and class conflict. Some people emphasize one or another. I think that there's no reason to say one is more important than the other in some kind of universal way. They're both constitutive processes which produce an endogenous dynamic of change. So first, competition. I think these points should be pretty self-evident. This shouldn't be, you know, sort of novel ideas, but it's still good, I think, to make it explicit rather than just to say competition does the work. Why does competition generate a dynamic in capitalism? Competition shouldn't be viewed mainly as a motivation by individual capitalist firms. You know, capitalists are profit maximizers, but that is not primarily because they're greedy. They may be greedy, so that's fine or bad. That may define a set of subjective motivations which make them even better at competition than they would otherwise be. But the logic of competition is not primarily about the motivations of actors. It's about the pressures they experience by virtue of being in a particular kind of economic structure. And the central idea is that in order to stay in business, capitalists have to worry about what other capitalists are doing. And in particular, they have to worry about the costs of production because other capitalists might sell their products more cheaply, and therefore it will be harder and harder to sell what you produce. So you have to worry about the costs of production, and you have to worry about what you're producing. So you may be just as efficient as someone else, but someone else produces a new product, everybody shifts from your product to their product. Not because it's cheaper, but because it's either better or just different. You know, it depends upon the logic of product competition. Lower costs of production that's a really crucial issue. It's hard to underestimate how important that is, because it's the central reason why innovations occur in a capitalist economy inside the process of production. So you can roughly think of capitalism as having two kinds of foci, sites for innovation. Firms innovate in what they produce. Apple 5 coming out, the 5 is the one that just came out? Yeah, so Apple.
There's another one.
Right, so you know, Apple continues to innovate. We've lived in a period since the information revolution, the digital revolution occurred, where the rate of product innovation has been just extraordinary, how rapidly things become completely obsolete. It's really, you know, quite astounding the speed at which product innovation. But there's also the behind the doors process innovation, which, you know, Madison is the site of one of the world's most creative innovators in robots. Isthmus Engineering is a robotics manufacturer. They manufacture custom designed robots. Fantastically cool to see these things, you know, assemble and manufacture things. Well, robotics produce things, but they produce it way more efficiently than the previous, whatever the previous machinery was. It's less a matter of substituting labor by machines. That's one way to innovate. It's more a question just of lowering the cost of production of per unit, which sometimes involves making a cheaper machine. But sometimes machines replace machines. It's not that the new machine replaces more workers. The new machine just replaces a more expensive old machine. And the new machine is, therefore, increases productivity, that is the total productivity, because it takes less inputs to produce a given output. Capitalists compete by price, increasing productivity, and they compete by products, figuring out new things to sell or new places to sell them. So from a capitalist point of view, it doesn't make much difference whether in a given market you're able to sell more because you've produced a new product, or you find an untapped market, a place that hasn't previously been exposed to your products, and you start selling your old products there. And they typically do both. That's one source of dynamics. Second source of dynamics is class conflict. We'll look at this as a dynamic aspect of capitalism when we look at the problem of exploitation. The week after when we talk about exploitation in particular. The basic issue here is that in all systems of production, no matter how automated, you still have to have people present to set the robots in motion and to repair the robots. That is, there's no such thing as a manufacturing system in which labor is completely absent. Labor can be dramatically reduced, but you still have a problem that human beings have to set this stuff in motion and monitor it and repair them when they break down.
With Lauren, the nanotechnology might change that, though.
It's possible. It's possible that they'll be self-repairing and self-monitoring. I suspect that the complexity of systems are such that there will always be people involved in the parameter setting. You know, in a sense, turning them on and off and monitoring output. It's not going to be seamless, but it could be. I mean, you know, it's in principle. It's not unthinkable that you could have a technology where people are completely absent. So you'd have one capitalist who owns the thing, and he, so to speak, turns on the factory and turns it off when he's done, so to speak, metaphorically. But still, in the world where we're currently at, there's always some people. And there's always then this problem of how do you get them to work as responsibly and effortful as you want. And the fact that human beings are themselves not robots, so that we, no matter how oppressed we are, have control over our own muscles and our own actions, that's always true. That's true under the most oppressive conditions, it's always true. Because we always have the possibility of dying, you know, willfully. So we always have a capacity for resistance. That poses a problem. And that's a problem for which there are technological solutions. So it creates another process of endogenous change. One of the reasons why capitalists are motivated to replace workers with machines is machines don't fight back. They may break down. That's the kind of the inanimate equivalent, I suppose, of fighting back. But it's only metaphorically fighting back. It's not really fighting back. It's just breaking down. It's an engineering problem, not a social problem. Whereas workers resist. In slave America, one of the major problems that slave owners had was how to get maximum effort out of slaves. And it wasn't that easy once the slave trade was reduced. Before the slave trade was reduced, a much harsher regimen of purely repressive slavery was viable because you could work your slaves to death and get replacements at reasonable cost. Once the international slave trade was stopped, the price of slaves very rapidly increased. And slaves became valuable means of production. And you couldn't just coerce them. You had to induce them to work. And so that was a problem, created a problem. The characteristic view of the lazy slave who's not so smart, you know, the kind of shuffling, and those were resistance strategies. Those were ways of resisting exploitation on the plantation. Worker shirking is always a problem in that sense. Okay, I mean, the point is just that that's another source of dynamics, having to deal with recalcitrant labor and having to deal with competition. Now, the thing that where I think the most distinctive contribution of Marxism to the analysis of capitalism comes from is not identifying capitalism as having a class structure and a market coordination mechanism. Adam Smith has basically those elements. Adam Smith recognizes that there's capitalism workers and that they are coordinated through markets. The invisible hand is Adam Smith's turn of phrase. Nor that this sets in motion dynamics, although I think Marx had a more subtle and refined way of thinking about those dynamics as such. The idea that this is a new system that's driving change, that's already present. Certainly Adam Smith's elegant analysis of the division of labor is precisely that. It's how capitalists figure out new ways of organizing the labor process in ways that massively improve productivity. What Marx identified is that there are contradictions in this process. That once it's set in motion, it doesn't just smoothly stay in motion. Contradictions are the key, and that's what the Harvey story is about. It's about the various ways in which he doesn't use the term contradiction much. He uses it at that one point where he says the contradictions are the accumulation. He uses the term barriers and overcoming barriers to accumulation. I think the notion of barriers is fine, but it's important to see the barriers as continually created by the process, as opposed to the barriers just being there and having to be overcome. And that's where the concept of contradiction comes in. A contradiction can be thought of as a barrier that's erected by the process itself. It's a barrier that's endogenous, that just doesn't happen to be there. It's something which gets generated by the process. I would define, I give a definition of contradiction. This would be the most general definition. This would apply to anything, not just capitalism. A contradiction means that there are chains of effects of a given process which disrupt the functioning of that process. So a process is contradictory when it sets in motion chains of effects which end up disrupting the process itself. Disrupting means there are barriers for the process to continue in a smooth way. Not all systems are contradictory in that way, but lots of systems have contradictory aspects. Contradiction does not mean that in the absence of removing the barrier, the system collapses. It doesn't follow that the chains of effects which disrupt the system cumulatively intensify those disruptions to the point where the process can't even continue. That would be one kind of contradiction. That's a system-threatening contradiction. But contradictions bring with them that flavor, you know, that there's that kind of suggestion that the disruption is not just an irritation. It's a disruption which, if left unattended, will get worse and worse. The term crisis, then, is used to describe this, the contexts where something has to be done about the disruption. The disruption can't just be ignored any longer, because it's not just making the process work less well. It's potentially calling into question the process. That's the kind of implication of the word crisis, and particularly when you add to it systemic crisis. Right? That's the suggestion. Sometimes the word crisis gets used in a kind of looser way. You know, it's sort of the equivalent of getting sick. So when you're sick, you can't function normally. If you're just a little bit sick, you can drag your tail around and sort of do your stuff, but with way less energy. If you get really sick, you basically have to stay in bed. But your body can also just repair itself because of your immune system, and you get over it without needing any special intervention. Other sicknesses, without special intervention, your system will be disrupted to the point where it dies. Okay. So if you're talking about having a physiological crisis, sometimes it would be used just when you can no longer go to work, you have to go home. Sometimes it refers to when, if something isn't done, you die. So the same is true in crisis discussions about capitalism. Sometimes the word crisis is used very loosely to mean any disruption that really causes a lot of grief and commotion. But sometimes those disruptions, even when they cause a lot of grief and commotion, just work themselves out. The ordinary business cycle seems to have that character. Even if you don't do anything about it, people suffer, there may be protests, but the system recovers. There's some reparative mechanisms inside of capitalist dynamics. Schumpeter called this creative destruction. And the system chugs along and it's muddling away in spite of the illness, and eventually gets back to a more robust state. But other times there are these crises that seem to have the character that you really have to rejigger the system. You really have to build some new institutions in order to get out of the mess. A lot of people think that's the current situation, that although there's some kind of repair going on, the economy's a little better now than it was a few years ago, there is a general sense that some more profound kinds of structural changes are needed, meaning new institutions built. in order for a more robust and smooth-running capitalism to be stabilized. Now, whether that's actually true or not, you know, that's something which only, really only in retrospect you can tell. Sort of 10 years from now, we'll see what the state of the capitalist economy is. We certainly haven't done that fundamental institutional rebuilding. You know, the kinds of changes which were provoked by the 2008-9 intensity of the crisis are pretty tame compared to what is at least many people think is needed in order to restore stable conditions for accumulation. But we'll see. I want to skip this next point, 4.3, about the an ambiguity in the analysis. It's a pretty interesting issue. I'll just tell you what the issue is, but I think it's more important for us to get on to the critique part of this session. But let me just tell you what this issue is. Many Marxists, and I think Harvey is actually guilty of this as well, there's one step in the analysis which has the character of a black box. That is, they don't really explain what the mechanism is. And this step in the analysis that's missing is, how do you go from the pressure of competition to generate profits, from that step, to the pressure of competition to force you to accumulate? So accumulation means you don't just have to make profits, but you have to use those profits in a particular way. That is to grow. You have to accumulate capital. You have to get bigger and bigger. Now, competition itself it's not obvious why competition forces firms to grow, forces capital to grow. Competition forces you to make profits, otherwise you go bankrupt. You have to make a profit. But what is it about competition that blocks capitalists from simply consuming all their profits? So one way of thinking about this is that in a capitalist system, workers get paid a wage, capitalists appropriate profits, and then they have to make a choice. How much of this am I going to consume, live high on the hog, and how much of it am I going to put back into the business? Now, putting part of what is called profits back into the business simply to maintain your machines, that's really not putting profits back into the business. That's just paying the costs of using up your machines. So we're talking about net profits, what you have left over after you've repaired all the machines, you know, they've depreciated, they need replacement, replace them, paid all your inputs, paid your labor, you have a net profit. That's the surplus value in the Marxian sense. Why not just consume it? What is it about competition that forces accumulation? And that remains largely a black box. The need for innovation doesn't force accumulation. The need for innovation just means you have to buy a better machine the next time. You have to replace your old machine with a more productive machine. It doesn't mean you have to get bigger. It may under very specific technological conditions, but it doesn't in general. Now, I do think capitalism needs to grow. I'm not denying this. I'm just saying that part of the story is usually not explicated. And in Harvey's book, he doesn't explicate it. I mean, that's, a weakness of the enigma of capital. He just assumes it and asserts it many times. I think there are, I'm doing what I said I was not going to do, explaining this point. It'll be in the notes, so you can read about it. And I specifically discuss I quote Harvey's analysis. But otherwise, it's already 10 to 9. We're going to encroach too much on the discussion. In the discussion, of course, you're free to say, okay, so what's the story there? That's a priority. All right, let's switch to the new... Did I pass out? No, I didn't pass out the new outline. Here. Have that one go that way, and this one go that way. Let's switch to the critique of capitalism. I think what I'll do is we'll probably go till about 10 or 15 after, and then take a short break and still have 35, 40 minutes. All right. Does everybody have their handout? Okay. They're basically, so here's a kind of general piece of advice. If you want to criticize an institution of whatever sort, give a social criticism. So you're talking about the family, or the university, or the economy, or the state, whatever institutions that you're evaluating. You've done your diagnosis of how it works and what its consequences are. And then you're saying, okay, now I want to organize my critical faculties to take this information and then organize it into a critique. They're basically two interconnected dimensions of criticism. One focuses on the harms generated in the lives of people by the institution, and the other focuses on the problem of justice and injustice. You can do a inventory of harms, ways in which this actually just interferes with people's lives, makes their lives go badly, or you can talk about the institutions being just or unjust. Now these are connected. You wouldn't care so much about an injustice unless it was associated with a harm, right? So there are injustices that one could say exist in the world, but nobody particularly suffers from them. And you say, all right, it's an injustice, but what's the big deal? So there are injustices within the elite world. Right? So if there's a club that will not admit rich people of Irish descent, it's an injustice. But you know, you say, well, the harm is pretty small, big deal, so the rich person doesn't have advantage to the extra networks that would make them even richer from being in that. It's by virtue of the connection of an injustice to a harm that the injustice gets bites. But there are different kinds of criticisms. And above all, you can criticize an institution for the harms it generates without having to then engage in what can sometimes be a very complicated debate about the nature of justice and injustice and whether this is just or unjust. You can just argue that it's harmful. Now, essentially, Marx in his practice advocated, didn't say it this way, but I think this is what it amounts to, that we should judge capitalism by the harms it creates, not by the injustices it produces. What's bad about capitalism is that it's bad for workers. Workers would do better. Their lives would go better under an alternative system. And he felt adding the additional indictment of capitalism not only is it bad for workers, but it's unjust, doesn't add anything in his view. That the language of injustice, he felt, was a liberal in the 19th century sense way of talking about things. And that wasn't the point. It was that capitalism was not in the interests of workers. And there was an alternative that would better serve their interests. And that's all that you need in order to justify, the word justice kind of sneaks its way back in a different meaning of the word, the struggle against capitalism. In the contemporary world, because of the way intellectual life has developed and the way, perhaps because of the way liberal theories have become common sense, and certain aspects of liberal understandings have become common sense, I think it's pretty hard to argue, to make these arguments without also bringing issues of justice to bear. And they do add something. And they particularly add something when you want to bring into alliance people who aren't harmed so much by the existing system, but might object to it because it's unjust. So there's a reason to focus on both the injustice aspects and the harm aspect, because the transformation of systems require very broad alliances of people. Now, I am not harmed much by capitalism, right? I mean, I'm in a university, an excellent university with a good salary that's extremely secure. You know, even Scott Walker isn't going to dismantle the tenure system for highly successful, valued professors. So, you know, I'm in an incredibly privileged position, and many of you come from privileged backgrounds, not all, but many do. And many of you will end up in privileged positions, not all, perhaps, but many. And yet you care about the harms generated in the world, and partially you care about them just because of the harms, but partially you care, I think, I suspect, because you think there's something just fundamentally unfair about the way the system works. And the unfairness of it adds an additional layer of opposition, and I think then brings together possibilities of broader coalitions. In any case, we'll discuss both of these. I mean, both aspects are relevant. Okay. Now, in the book, I lay out 11 criticisms of capitalism. I don't know if I mentioned this, you know, why there's 11 in the... So the number 11 has a certain iconic status in the Marxist tradition, because Marx wrote in his, when he was a young man, a treatise that was a critique of a particular German philosopher, Feuerbach. And in that critique, he has 11 theses. And the 11th thesis is very famous, right? It's one of these little things that's become part of the culture of the left. The 11th thesis on Feuerbach is philosophers have only tried to interpret the world. The point is to change it. That's the 11th thesis. So when I originally wrote the chapter, I had 10 criticisms of capitalism. And I really thought, oh, come on, it wouldn't be nice to have 11. So what I did was, it wasn't entirely in the effort of a poetic moment, but I separated out consumerism from the general environmental issue. I think the main indictment of consumerism that doesn't have simply a lifestyle character, you know, me passing judgment on other people's preferences, the main aspect of consumerism that isn't that is that it is damaging to the environment, that a society that values and whose health depends upon people buying stuff is one that doesn't respect the environment and is damaging. And the world cannot be a consumerist world in the future if the ecological issues are to become manageable. So I had previously had consumerism as a subpart of the environmental sustainability criticism. But I decided to promote it to its own item on the list. And that's also because I think consumerism is a damaging way of life for the people who participate in it. And that's a much harsher and more judgmental stand. And I prefer to avoid, in general, passing judgment on people's choices in that way. It has a certain elitist arrogance, particularly if you're a relatively high earner and live a comfortable lifestyle, to criticize people for consumerism. You know, it sounds snotty. So I don't like the tone of that typical, but I also feel it's right. So that's why I elevate it. Okay, that's a little biographical anecdote about how intellectual work sometimes proceeds. In any case, that was a list of 11. It wasn't, as if you've read the chapter, it wasn't tightly organized in any logical way. I didn't group those 11 under different rubrics. It's just a list, kind of a laundry list, as sometimes it's said. What I'd like to do here is to organize not every item on that list, but many of them, under the four normative principles that we discussed in the first lecture. So if you remember, in the earlier discussion where I was laying out the normative foundations of an emancipatory social science, or at least of the emancipatory social science as I pursue it, there were four principles, or four core values: equality, democracy, community, and sustainability. Those were the four values from the that earlier lecture that I announced were the foundations for my way of understanding the tasks of diagnosis and critique. So I think an alternative way of presenting the critique of capitalism then is to simply say, how well does capitalism do with respect to each of these values? The value of equality, democracy, community, and sustainability. There's a fourth value, which one would want to add, which would capture some of the remaining criticisms of capitalism. And it would be the value of efficiency or rationality. It's more complicated, and I didn't want to get into that. I mean, we can talk about that, but there's ways in which capitalism is irrational. You know, the ways in which capitalism harms everybody, capitalists included, that it is simply an irrational system. It causes irrational things to happen, that it's not in anybody's interests. That's not fully captured by equality, democracy, community, and sustainability. But I'm not going to address that directly here. So let me just very quickly run through each of these values and just give you the central idea for why it is that capitalism violates them. So first, equality. The equality value, as I laid it out, is in a just society, all persons would have broadly equal access to the material and social means necessary to live a flourishing life. That's what it means, I think, to be an egalitarian, is to endorse something like that claim. An egalitarian is somebody who believes that in a just world, all people would have broadly equal access to the conditions to live a flourishing life. So how well does capitalism do with respect to that? The central thesis of the critique would be, capitalism inherently generates levels of inequality in income and wealth that systematically violate social justice. It's a commonly held view that inequality as such should not be of particular concern. We should care about deprivation of poverty, those are real harms in the lives of people, but not about inequality as such. So there's a common view that the justice issues aren't very significant. What really matters are people suffering. That's the poverty problem, so to speak, not the inequality problem. Now, I certainly agree that the most pressing moral issue connected to inequality, the thing that really gives it moral bite, is the suffering connected to poverty. That's the point I made at the outset of this discussion, that if there were no harms associated with the injustice, we wouldn't care about the injustice so much. So it's certainly true that poverty and deprivation more broadly are the reasons why the injustice of inequalities has bite. Nevertheless, I think inequality itself is an appropriate aspect or object of moral concern. And I think there are four principal reasons for this. There are four reasons why we should care about inequality and about the inequalities generated by capitalism. And the first, and I think is probably the most important, and which is a complicated idea, so this may initially not sound so complicated, but it really is a hard idea. So various times I introduce things that are difficult. It takes a lot of thinking, concentration to really get the point here. Inequality is itself a cause of poverty. Inequality causes poverty. It's a cause of poverty. The rich are rich in part because the poor are poor. Or another way to put it is that the rich are rich at the expense of the poor. Poverty and wealth are not causally independent of each other. It's not that we have some causal processes going on in the world which produce some people poor and some people rich, but they're unconnected. Now, that you could imagine a world like that. I mean, just imagine the following. You have two farmers on adjacent plots of land. The land has the same fertility. They have the same means of production. One is the grasshopper, one is the ant. One works all summer, the other sits under a tree smoking a pipe, or whatever the story is. And at the end of the summer, one starves, in the winter, one starves, and one has bounty. Well, one's rich and one's poor in the winter, but they're not causally connected. There's nothing that the rich farmer did explains anything about why the poor farmer is poor. So those are causally independent. Now, a lot of economists act as if that's the world in which we live. You know, a lot of this human capital stuff about rich and poor is basically an attempt at arguing that we're cultivating our own garden, our own human capital, and people simply choose their level of income on the basis of how lazy or effortful they are in acquiring human capital. It's an absurd idea. I mean, it's not that it has not, there isn't a kernel of truth in it. It has some, it's tapping into some mechanisms. So I wouldn't say that the only reason, the only causal factor involved in the poverty of the poor is the wealth of the rich. It's not just because of that, but that is the central, it's the causal interconnection. The way this interconnection is understood in Marxism is through the concept of exploitation. So exploitation is an argument, it's a way of diagnosing the mechanisms that generate inequality that simultaneously explain why the rich are rich and why the poor are poor. When we discuss exploitation in 2 weeks, we're going to add an additional concept which is not one that Marx uses, but which is equally important in this problem, and it's what I will refer to as non-exploitative oppression, which is also relevant to this question, the causal interconnection between the advantages of some and the disadvantages of others. But the key idea, and the one that's important for the present context, and that which makes this a central criticism of capitalism, is that the kind of inequalities generated within capitalism perpetuate severe deprivation even in the face of substantial economic growth. That's the key idea. Capitalism does generate growth. It's one of its dynamic and positive features. But it perpetuates poverty in the midst of plenty, not by accident. That's not simply something that happens in capitalism. It's central to the very mechanism by which the growth is generated. Another way of saying this, which is a way that I think has a particularly kind of salient bite, is that capitalism perpetuates eliminable forms of human suffering. Now, what that means is if somebody says to you, but look, capitalism has produced all this wondrous growth, the average standard of living is higher now than 100 years ago, isn't this a great achievement? In China, this is often said, right, that China has had this unbelievable 3 decades of growth. There are many middle-class, comfortable people in China now, way, way more as a proportion of the population than before. And sure, there's some poverty still. It may be quite substantial in the countryside, but this is just a matter of time. You know, it takes time to get rid of it. The claim is not that capitalism doesn't provide growth and that many people may benefit from that growth, not just the richest people, but that it also perpetuates unnecessary forms of human suffering, eliminable forms of human suffering. That's the critique. The critique is that it obstructs the full realization of its potential, not that it doesn't do some things which embody improvements. So that's the first point. That's most important. Inequality matters because it is causally connected to poverty. It's not just that poverty is a independently produced phenomenon. And the second issue concerns social justice itself. So we want to make a distinction between, let me make a distinction between two states of the world. First, everyone has access to the material means to live a flourishing life, but not equal access. Everybody has access to what it takes to flourish, but they have unequal access. and a second world, everyone having roughly equal access to the means to live a flourishing life. So these are two possible worlds. One is everybody has access to live a flourishing life, but some people have way easier access than others. And the second world is everyone has equal access. Now, if the first of these holds but not the second, then some people have to work much harder than others to acquire the means to flourish, but everyone could still, with enough effort, acquire those means. One way of thinking about absolute poverty is that the first condition is not satisfied. No matter how hard some people work, they can't acquire the necessary means to live a flourishing life. So that means that even the first world doesn't exist. Capitalism inherently violates that first condition. In capitalism, not everyone will have access to the means to live a flourishing life, no matter how hard they work. But even apart from that, even if we had strong welfare state institutions which are non-capitalist in character and that they neutralize this damaging effect of capitalism by guaranteeing that everybody will have access to the means to live a flourishing life, it's just that some people have to work much harder for it. So even if we could do this so that the first world was, we were in the first world, Sweden would be an example where we're in the first world. Everybody, I mean, it's not quite true, but it's true enough for the present purposes. Everybody will have access to the material conditions to live a flourishing life. It's just that for some people it's much easier than others. Capitalism would still be violated by the inequality principle. And particularly so long as the material conditions of life of children are substantially affected by the income of their parents, nothing close to equal access to the conditions to flourish will be possible in a capitalist system. So this is just a way of saying that in addition to the harms of capitalism, there's an injustice. And that is intrinsic to capitalism. Finally, there's an additional comment, except we're running out of time. High levels of inequality have adverse effects on the lives of most people, even people who are relatively privileged. Now, this is a pretty controversial claim, that inequality harms the advantaged as well as the disadvantaged. And not necessarily, I find it a little bit strained to say that Bill Gates is harmed by the inequalities of capitalism. That is, his life would go better if he didn't have so much wealth and we redistributed to a more egalitarian condition. Some people make that argument. I think that's a stretch. But I do think that the harms of inequality go way up in the income distribution, way beyond the people who would be ordinarily just thought of the people who are living lives of real deprivation. This argument has been most famously advanced in a very interesting book by Wilkinson and Pickett called The Spirit Level. It's a book I recommend if you haven't seen it. It's a stupid title. It's a really bad title, The Spirit Level. It refers to the carpenter's level in Britain are called spirit levels. It's a dreadful title because it doesn't say anything about what the book is about. What the book shows is that things like the average life expectancy of people in the top 10% of the income distribution are lower than people when the income distribution is very unequal than when the income distribution is less unequal. The median life expectancy, it's in the middle. The life expectancy of people in the middle is lower when they live in the middle of a highly unequal society than they live in the middle of a more equal society, even if their income is higher in the unequal society. So on all sorts of indicators, life is worse for people living in a society that has huge amounts of inequality. The mechanisms for this center around stress, conflict, envy, intensified competition. Highly unequal societies are also highly competitive societies in modern capitalist conditions. One of the things which makes them unequal is that they have unbridled competition. And unbridled competition makes life miserable for people. Even people who succeed because their lives are stressed in ways that they wouldn't be. In a social order with different rules that modify and contain competition and accordingly modify and contain the inequalities. All right, let me more quickly just run through the remainder of this. That's the equality critique. Democracy. Capitalism generates severe deficits in realizing democratic values. By excluding crucial decisions from public deliberation, by allowing private wealth to affect access to political power, and by allowing workplace dictatorships. The first of these is the most fundamental. And we'll be returning to this in many different contexts, particularly when we discuss theories of the state. This will become a relevant consideration there as well. It's an intrinsic feature of private property that it gives power to the owners of property to dispose of it as they like. That's what it means to own something, is that you can do with it what you want. I can sell it, I can destroy it, I can move it. If a capitalist was not allowed to move a firm to a cheap labor economy without asking the permission of the workers in the firm, you know, if you had to have a vote of everybody who worked in the firm, whether you could fire them and move the firm to Mexico, if you had to ask permission, it would no longer be a capitalist firm. You know, that would be a fundamental transformation of the nature of the property relations over the means of production. If capitalists had to ask permission to move their factory to a place where they would make higher profits. So the ability of capitalists to control the allocation of their investments and disinvestments is absolutely fundamental to what renders the system capitalist in the first place. What that means is that capitalists inherently have power to make decisions that have massive effects on the lives of other people without asking their permission. And that's a violation of democracy. Because that's the core democratic value, at least as I understand the core democratic value is, people should be empowered to participate in decisions which affect their lives. You know, the decision's being made that's going to have a significant effect on your life, you should be party to the decision. If the decision doesn't have anything to do with you, there's no reason for you to be party to the decision. So treating it from the other angle, your own decisions, when you make decisions that affect you and only you, that's fine. You don't have to ask anybody's permission. And we call that individual liberty, the ability to autonomously act on those terrains where your actions only affect you. When your actions affect other people, they should be party to the decision that you're making. That is the, I think, the normatively, the democratic distinction between private and public. That is, the democratic distinction between private and public is the private are those things which affect you and only you. The public are those things that you do that affect other people as well. Now, of course, drawing that line of demarcation is difficult, probably impossible to do it a priori. We certainly don't want to draw it so narrowly that anything you do that has even a little bit of effect on somebody, they should be party to the decision. That would make life intolerable. So what we want, I think, normatively, from a pragmatic point of view, is a fairly expansive space of private decision making, where you really have autonomy to do what you want, even though some of the things you do when you do what you want impinge on other people. And it's a negotiation. It has to do with norms and culture and the way civil life develops over time, how you navigate that boundary condition. But surely the boundary condition doesn't include being able to close a factory and put thousands of people out of work and destroy the property values of people's homes by moving your factory to another country. That's way on the other side of the public-private boundary with respect to democratic values. And that's intrinsic to capitalism. That's not just a possible feature of capitalism. I'm also, of course, I'm repeating things that are in the reading here too. So I don't. This is always a dilemma that I face. I'll moan and groan about this periodically during the semester. I get excited about this stuff. I really like talking about it. I hope it's not just, you know, the kind of negative version is that professor really likes to hear himself talk, right? So I hope you're not grumbling inside your head with that indictment, which is the feared indictment of a professor. I like talking about this stuff, and so I find it hard on some topics to keep it under wraps so we have time. Okay, there's community and sustainability still to go. There's more to say about democracy. I think we should take our break and reconvene at 11:30 and start our discussion there. And the stuff I wrote about community and solidarity, that's not in any of the writings. That's something I've added since then. Okay, so when we come back, I'll give a 2-minute version of it. But let's have our discussion when we return. And let's make it a little bit shorter than usual, 11:30, okay?